My name is Barry Brooking. I was born in Saltash in 1944. Spent a lot of my life, unfortunately, away from Saltash, but I'm back now in my retirement, and this will probably be my last stop.
Oh, so you're definitely planted. I was introduced to Barry because he knows so much about Saltash and particularly the war, but I'd also be really interested to find out if you've got any of your own personal stories, like young stories of you as a child in Saltash, if you've got any memory of that. Or, but I'm really happy for you just to wax lyrical, really. And
fine. Well, my parents got married in Kent during the war, I think about 1942, and my mother came from Kent. My father was in the Merchant Navy, and they got married. I came along about a couple of years later, and when I was going to be born, my father put a request to my mother. I think the best decision I always told him that he ever did was, could I go down to Saltash, which was his hometown, to be born?
Aww.
Because that would make me Cornish. And the result was that my mother, just before I was born, went down, and my step-grandmother, because my father's original mother had died of appendicitis.
Right.
These days, perhaps people don't die of appendicitis,
no,
but they did then. So he remarried. So my his stepmother, my step-grandmother, and her sister looked after my mother towards the end of her confinement, and I was born in Saltash. And my father did that because he wanted me to be Cornish.
Aww.
So I always told him it was the best decision, I think, that he ever made.
Oh, that's lovely.
We then only spent 2.5 years in Saltash, and he was moved to Milford Haven in Pembrokeshire, where he was shipping master, and then Chatham in Kent, and then back to Saltash. Unfortunately, and it was awful really, he was the youngest qualified Admiralty river pilot in the country.
Right.
But a couple of years after moving back to Saltash, he had a problem with his eyesight. In the war, he'd got hit in the eye, and he developed a cataract and other things, and he was invalided out in his early 40s.
Oh, wow, okay.
He would have gone on to, I think, a really good, high-earning career, because he was the youngest ever to qualify.
Mm.
But he was invalided. Any job he could get that they found him was as a clerical assistant.
Right.
For someone who'd been handling aircraft carriers like HMS Eagle from the sea into Devonport Dockyard, this was quite different.
Yeah, yeah.
And it perhaps came close to breaking him in many ways psychologically, but they just purchased a house in Saltash or through a mortgage. This was 1962, and 2,250 for a two-bedroom bungalow.
Wow.
In Saltash.
Those are the days.
Yeah, so the family income dropped by 60%.
Yeah.
At a time when I was going off to university.
Wow, okay.
So I couldn't ask my parents for any financial help. 3 pretty hard years. But then it changed when I joined the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
But he did, thankfully, manage to serve the community, because he was lacking something as a civil servant after his sea time, and the local councillor said, why don't you try to become a councillor? So he did, and he got onto Saltash Council, and then eventually became a mayor.
Oh, wow.
He was made a freeman, which he was very proud of, because they don't make many of those.
No.
And then he was a councillor for Carradon District Council, and was chairman.
Wow.
So
okay.
The family really serve the community. I was away from Saltash at that time earning my living, but we've obviously got a very strong family background in Saltash.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. So in many ways, like you say, that would have been quite a very hard thing for an active person to kind of have to resign themselves to the fact they're going to be at a desk, but then to actually turn that around and become really active, well, in the community is fantastic, isn't it?
I admired him tremendously,
yeah,
because he'd been a master mariner. He'd been the master of his own ship. He'd handled very large warships. And
wow,
suddenly then to be a clerical assistant with 16 and 17-year-olds,
yeah,
of the same status or rank. But typical of him, and I hope the family, he went to night school. Not easy in your 40s.
No, sure.
And sitting alongside 16-year-olds.
Yeah, yeah.
And he qualified himself and made several promotions in that time.
Wow.
But he never really fully recovered from the impact of having lost a job that he'd done all of his life.
Yeah.
He'd always been on the sea and the river. And but he put those energies into the community. And even now, 20-odd years after he died, people still stop me in Fore Street and remember him.
Oh.
Which is really lovely.
Yeah.
It happened 3 or 4 times last Saturday at a social event. And people I don't know, but it's so lovely now to find that people respected and liked him so much when he was doing his council work.
So was he known as Councillor Brooking then, or would they call him Alfred? Or
well, a variety of things.
It's
actually a very good question, because yes, some called him Councillor Brooking, some called him Mr. Brooking, some called him Alfred, but a lot of people called him Alf.
Oh, that's nice.
This did not please my mother.
Okay.
She didn't like him being called Alf. I don't know why, but I thought it was a term of endearment. But he was known by many things. But he set up the first housing surgery, because he was aware. This was when MPs had surgeries every week for their constituencies. However, he set up the first one because he was aware that housing, social housing, was a problem. And in the Guild Hall, once every so often, he would be in there behind a table, just like an MP, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, I think he would have made a brilliant MP.
Right.
However, he was a councillor, and he tried to help people get a roof over their heads.
Wow, that sounds amazing. We could do with him still here now, couldn't we? Because it's a big problem for people at the moment, yeah.
And he had a very good relationship, especially with our local MP, who at the time was Sir Robert Hicks.
Right,
he became a family friend, and when he used to come down from Parliament, say on a Friday, he would go and have a sandwich pasty lunch, pasty probably, with Dad at Liscard at the Carradon District Council offices, when Dad was chairman, and they would look at how to help the constituents. So he was working hand in glove with the local MP.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm just going to check my just that this is working properly. It is. Can I ask you something a bit about then? So obviously you all had a love of the water. I know it was like he was in the Navy and you've become the Navy. Do you have any kind of water-based stories of memories with him?
Not necessarily with him. I think the only story I have is when we were in Milford Haven in Pembrokeshire, and the Royal Yacht came, the Queen came, to the River Cleddai, and he took a motorboat out with a number of the people who lived in the local married quarters, and we went around the Britannia trying to see the Queen, and one of the men lost his hat, so Dad went and turned the boat round and picked up the hat and gave it back to the gentleman who lost it.
Oh, on the Britannia?
This was on the motorboat going around. I lost my cap because it was windy and he wouldn't go back.
get yours.
I felt a bit aggrieved at that, but not really stories. He took his job very seriously, and obviously I wasn't able to be with him when he was handling these big ships and so on. But what did happen, there was a connection, because I eventually joined the Royal Navy, and that was interesting, and I think it pleased him, though he always teased me that the Royal Navy cap badge has a rope around it, so it's actually a fouled anchor, whereas the Merchant Navy doesn't.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So he would always teasing me that the Merchant Navy was better.
So he was Merchant Navy, and you were Royal Navy.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And I went to Dartmouth. I served in the Royal Navy for 16 years. Could have gone on to a full career, but my wife at the time and I decided it would be a good time to leave so she could pursue her ambitions. She eventually became a professor of nursing, one of the first in the country. He always said, and I think he could be right, that what, in his view, impacted on and destroyed my royal career, my naval career, was that at one stage I volunteered to do a green beret and commando training
right.
during my naval career.
Right.
I wanted a bit of fun. Well, it wasn't fun, at least not getting the green beret. But what happened was that I had 36 hours notice to leave a ship in the Far East, where I was the squadron meteorological officer.
Wow.
And the naval officer ahead of me, who should have gone to the commando, broke a leg on the course.
Wow.
So I had 36 hours notice to leave the ship to go to Limpstone to qualify.
Yeah.
And I was not commando fit at that time by any means. And then 36 hours later, I was, having got the green beret, I was in Northern Ireland
because
my unit was spearhead.
Wow.
And they'd gone to Belfast a week or two before.
Wow.
And I then joined them.
Wow, okay.
I then spent the next 4 years, longer than I should have done in some ways, but they were happy to have me, doing three tours in Northern Ireland.
Wow, okay.
Operational. And then I went back to the Navy where, to be honest, and it was before the Falklands, I was a bit bored.
Right.
And he always reckoned it was because of my love for the Royal Marine Commandos and the fact I'd been on active service that they destroyed my naval career.
Oh.
I have to say he could well be right.
Oh.
Because I think if you join the armed services, you perhaps feel that you should be involved in active service.
Right.
And at that time, the Navy wasn't.
Mm.
It was very much a peacetime Navy. Mm. Royal Marine Commandos were ever normally at the front of the action, and that at that time happened to be in Northern Ireland.
Mm.
And I'd had my my three operational tours before they decided it was time I went back to the Navy.
Right, okay. Wow, crikey. That's quite hard stuff, actually, isn't it? That must have been quite daunting being there as well.
It was interesting.
Yeah,
But you see, the thing is that you spend lots of time training. So to have to do it for real, to me, should be the ambition of anyone who's in the armed services.
Yeah,
and it matters because you're doing a job for the country. It may be contentious to many people doing internal security in your own country, but it matters. And if you make mistakes, people can get killed on either side.
Yeah.
But it was formative for me. I'd learnt a lot about myself, and I think you do.
Mm.
When you're on active service, you certainly learn a lot about yourself that you can't possibly know in civilian life.
Right, okay, yeah.
And it brings out, I know, the best and perhaps the worst of people.
Yeah.
Saltash has a remarkable history. What a lot of people don't know is that at one stage it was bigger than Plymouth. And there is an old saying that goes, Saltash was a market town when Plymouth was a fuzzy down. And that's true, because Plymouth at one time was three towns, and then they amalgamated and became the Plymouth that we now know, 400,000 people, whatever it is, probably at one time mainly on the back of the dockyard. And there's a story about that. But Saltash, of course, because it's on the River Tamar, has a big fishing history. But on the other hand, probably the main part was in the early days, there was a probable Roman encampment just outside, about a mile outside, where there is now Tremerton Castle. People think of Tremerton Castle quite rightly as the Normans, and that was really the, you'd probably say, could be the main centre, because where there was a castle, you'd have a market, and that's where the area was governed by. But you also, a mile and a bit away, had the link across a ferry to Devon. So you had two separate parts, if you like. And they coexisted. As far as the river's concerned, the Danes are known to have come up here. They didn't want to stay, but they got as far up as almost Tavistock. And then, of course, the Normans came and they took over the area and, of course, went way down into to Cornwall. We did have a problem here over the Prayer Book Rebellion in 1549, and a lot of Cornish were not happy that the post-Reformation Book of Prayer was read out in English rather than Latin. A number of Cornish people then, I think, would have actually spoken Cornish, and they set siege to Tremerton Castle. They took Tremerton Castle, I think the only time it was ever taken, they say by treachery. And the story there is, apparently, they got into the castle by treachery, but then they wanted all of the valuables, Can't say that's much to do with prayer book and no. a rebellion. And apparently the story goes that the ladies said they couldn't get their rings off, and they were told that if they couldn't, then their fingers would be cut off instead. I think we can assume that the ladies did manage to remove their rings. It was the only time that Tremerton Castle was subject to conflict or war. The rest of the time it was a centre for governance. In the Elizabethan and Spanish Wars, of course, there was a worry that the Spaniards would come along, and Saltash was an important area. It had a dock or dockyard, and a lot of Saltash men would have probably fought in the against the Armada, because they were very good fishermen, and you wanted fishermen to help man the ships that went against the Spanish Armada. Drake is known to have come here with a treasure ship, with a lot of money's worth of stuff that he'd managed to take from the Spaniards, and of course he gave a lot of it to Elizabeth I and was knighted. He courted a young lady called Drake married a young woman, and she was his first wife, but she died, and then later he, of course, through all of his money, bought Buckland Abbey in Devon. And we know more about her. In the English Civil War, Saltash was the most garrisoned town in Cornwall. It was royalist for the most part. It had a number of sieges, probably around half a dozen. And because it was royalist, it was in quite a precarious position, because Plymouth was parliamentarian. So it was heavily fortified. It was so bad that when Daniel Defoe, the author, came much, much later, he still reckoned that Saltash was a little shattered town,
right,
because of the number of sieges. Much smaller, of course, than it is now. It was probably had about 1,000 men garrisoned here, and for the most part, southeast Cornwall was royalist, though they, of course, lost the war. Again, there were gun batteries and various things around Saltash to protect it. In the French Napoleonic Wars, again, Saltash men would have helped in the fleet, possibly at Trafalgar and other places, of course, because they had brilliant seamen. And there is a story that at one stage at this time, Saltash was recommended, not many people know this, as Her Majesty's Dockyard.
Oh, right, OK.
It was felt it was a better site. It did have a dock where ships would be built and come in and be repaired. However, the Saltash fishermen objected, because there was an oyster fishery and fishery. And because of that opposition, it was actually not going to get the dockyard. The person, I believe, the surveyor who recommended, had a wonderful name, Sir Julius Caesar. And, of course, when the war was over and Napoleon was on HMS Bellerophon in the Sound, or Hammerers, then Saltash people are known to have gone out in small boats to try to catch a sight of him,
right,
before he was sent into exile. We have a VC winner here. William Odgers was the first VC, or man, to be awarded a Victoria Cross in the Maori Wars in 1843 to 1872. And he later retired and became a publican of the Waterside Inn. In the Boer War, we had a man from just outside Saltash who was called Sir William Penn Simmons. He was the first general officer to be killed in the Boer War. The story goes that he was at the head of his troops on a white horse.
Wow.
Now, if you're going up against Boer marksmen, some of the finest shots in the world, farmers and so on, you do not go at the front of your men riding a white horse. He did, and he was shot and killed. There was a tremendous outburst of grief at that time in the Boer War. And Saltash did send a number of people out to the Boer War. Weird, we've talked about this, started off as a camp just outside Saltash in the First World War. And many, many people were trained there, billeted there, out at Weird. And they went off to the First World War from Saltash Ferry and railway station, and we have photographs of that, and I always think how really poignant it was that when you look at those photographs you realise perhaps only about one in four or five actually returned. and their last sight of Cornwall would have been looking back from the ferry or the train at Cornwall and or their hometown of Salt Ash. I find that very poignant. Mm. And they probably knew when they were going away, certainly at the middle and end of the war, that their chances of coming back wouldn't be very good. In the war, the ferry, of course, ferried a lot of people off to war, as did the Royal Albert Bridge and the railway station. We had an important naval base here called HMS Defiance. And this was, in fact, a torpedo training establishment. And in addition to that, a man called Captain Jackson, who later became Admiral of the Fleet, was very much into radio. And not many people know this, but it was a world's first. The first time a radio signal was sent from one end of a ship to another, and then from one ship to another ship, was actually made just off Salt Ash. He was a friend of Marconi, a colleague of Marconi, and it revolutionised things for war at sea, because, of course, it meant that you could communicate with your own ships in terms of fighting battles at sea. Salt Ash has only had one warship named after it, and that was a Hunt-class minesweeper launched towards the end of World War One. Didn't have much to do in World War One, but again, importantly, the ship saw action in World War Two at the Dunkirk evacuation and the Normandy landings. And again, that's something that people don't know about. There is one story that, again, came to light a few years ago, in that Salt Ash has a link, albeit tenuous, if you look at it as a wartime link, with Lawrence of Arabia. Not many people knew this until recently, including me. Now, Colonel Lawrence fought as Lawrence of Arabia, that's what he was called, as you know, in the Middle East against the Turks with an Arab army. After the war, he looked for anonymity. That's all he was looking for. And he joined the RAF as an air craftsman. They found him a job at RAF Mountbatten, which is near Plymouth, just over the other side of the Tamar. And he was employed in the design and work of motor cruisers, fast motorboats, that could go out into the western approaches and rescue downed pilots from their aircraft, because they were very valuable. Mm-hmm. Pilots were more valuable in every sense than a plane. A pilot was a human being and took a lot of training. An aeroplane could be replaced quite quickly. So the pilots were very, very important. And he was involved in that. And the story goes that one evening, and he'd been lent a motor cruiser by his commanding officer, he was cruising up the River Tamar, and it was misty. A local fisherman heard this motorboat going along and suddenly stopping and realised something was wrong. So he went out into the Tamar, probably realised that there was a mud bank there, rescued the occupant of the motor cruiser and towed it back, and it was T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. So he took him home, gave him a meal, and apparently they became friends, and apparently Lawrence used to come over occasionally to see him in a friendly capacity in Salt Ash and have a beer.
That's really nice.
In the Second World War, of course, Salt Ash was very much involved as something of a target because it was so close to Plymouth. The Royal Albert Bridge, Brunel Bridge, some people call it, was a major target for the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. And if you look at 4th Street, it runs parallel to that bridge. So, of course, there's always the possibility of bombs being dropped on Salt Ash that were intended for the bridge. So although Salt Ash didn't suffer anything like as badly as Plymouth, it did have some bombs. And in one night, I think 9 people were killed in one night. Yeah. There was a scout, auxiliary fire service unit. Again, that's something I'm proud of for Salt Ash. It was the first and possibly the only scout troop run auxiliary fire service unit in the whole of the country. Wow. And one of its members was killed, a scout, and he got the scout's equivalent I think it's called the Bronze Cross, which is the equivalent to the Scouts of the Victoria Cross.
Wow, so it's young.
He was 19.
Yeah,
wow. He was fairly old for a scout, but he was a scout. And then, of course, the town went through the Second World War with the usual privations that most towns went through. Again, I can talk in more detail if you wish, but basically what happened there was probably similar to many other towns, perhaps more than some towns in Cornwall because of its proximity to Plymouth. Perhaps docks like Falmouth would have also been bombed quite a bit,
yeah,
but
they were,
that would be it. Down at Sand Key, which is part of Waterside at Saltash, there was a United States Navy repair yard for servicing assault or landing craft. And they were particularly busy just prior to Normandy. So they were based on this side of the Tamar at Saltash to repair and renovate those ships. On the outskirts of the town, at Carkeel, a couple of miles outside the main town, there were aircraft batteries, barrage balloons, the usual roadblocks, and, of course, what we would call Dad's Army, the local Home Guard. And there was even a prisoner of war camp just outside at a place called Bake, near Trerul Foot. At Pentilly Castle, which again is about 2 or 3 miles from Saltash, there was a maternity hospital, and that was set up during the war. So I know several people who are very proud that on their birth certificate it says place of birth Pentilly Castle. It makes them feel like aristocrats. What I can't understand though is why I was born in 1944 and I was born in a house rather than Pentilly Castle. But I've got to live with that. There was quite a lot of bomb damage throughout Saltash, but as I say, nothing like as bad as Plymouth. And almost up to date, and one could almost say the war history of Saltash goes from castle, the Roman castle or Norman castle of Tremerton, right up to a Cold War bunker. And in 1959, because of the tension between our country and the West and Russia, a Cold War bunker to monitor fallout from atom or hydrogen bombs was built about 3 miles outside Saltash.
Wow.
No one really knew about it, and it's still there, of course. That really brings us up to date with regard to the war history of Saltash. I'm very proud to say, and I hope to have played a small part in it, that Saltash really does respect those who lost their lives in war. And we have 42 Saltash service graves, 21 World War I, 20 from World War II, and a host of memorials. And a few years ago, I was privileged to be asked to join the World War I committee. I think that was 2017, in preparation for 2018 to commemorate the end of World War I, and Weird Camp does come into that. What I should have said over Weird Camp was it wasn't just a camp for soldiers to be based and to be trained, but towards the end of the war, when it wasn't needed so much, it was set up as a convalescent hospital. So a number of people came to that hospital to recover from their wounds for the time that it existed. And one of the things that comes out is not only do we commemorate through plaques, memorials and events those from Saltash who lost their lives, but we've also welcomed people. And whether it be people not from Saltash who are based here, including of course the people on HMS Defiance, or there was a training ship called Mount Edgecombe for difficult boys. There's a theme that comes out, which I'm very proud to comment on, which is that Saltash has always been a good host. It's always been a caring town, looking after people who have come to live here. Whether it be the boys of Mount Edgecombe, And the locals were a bit worried at first because it was like a boar store in many ways. And only the worst boys, they say, came to a training ship to have the harsh naval discipline. But the locals soon realised that they were so well trained, they weren't going to be a threat. And there is evidence that there was a very good relationship there. The sailors who worked in HMS Defiance, the same. Weird Camp, the soldiers who were based there. Perhaps even more so, the terribly wounded people in the convalescent centre at Weird Camp. All of these people have gone on record saying how well they were received and looked after by the people of Saltash. And that still continues to this day with some Ukrainian families who are here. And I'm very proud of my hometown that that's been recorded throughout the ages, and shows perhaps that we Essanians or Saltash people and Cornish people can, as well as perhaps being a bit rebellious at times. And I would include myself in that, especially as a member of Trelawney's Army, the Cornish rugby supporters group. And we do, I think, prove to be good hosts and a good place to live and a caring place. A lot of people say that, Rebecca, that I wear whatever I've managed to achieve lightly, and I would like that to continue. But what I'm going to do now is to say something to you, because I hope it reflects well on Saltash.
Yes.
That's the only reason I'm doing it. Not for me.
Yeah.
And that is that after my service in Northern Ireland, I was awarded an MBE. I'm very proud of that, but I don't promote
don't go.
It
oh,
in,
yes,
in
yes.
that way. But it is a fact that I was only 28. It was most unusual for a naval officer to be appointed MBE. And I'm not sure that anyone else in Saltash ever managed that honour. I'm very proud of it. I never talk about it. The only reason I'm saying it is if it reflects on Saltash in a nice way. But obviously my parents were very pleased, and I was delighted that the Colonel and others had recognised what I'd actually done as a naval officer in a Royal Marine Commando unit. So, you know, you can use that, but could you use it with discretion?
Yes.
Because not a load of people know in Saltash about it. Occasionally people use it after my name, so I can't deny it, and it is true, and it goes back to 1973. But on the other hand, I don't even wear the medal on remembrance, because I come from a very modest family, and I think that's important to me. But if it is good for Saltash, then I would be happy to share that with you.
So with that, if we were kind of we're recording you, obviously, and we'll if it's put into Crescent Kernow archive, would you be happy with us to put your name MBE Saltash?
I'm not unhappy about that. I'm happy for other people to refer to it, Rebecca.
Yeah.
I don't like to be direct.
No.
In it.
For
many years, I didn't know, but Trevor Howard had a military cross.
Right.
He never used it.
No.
But it does come out, and I thought he was a brilliant actor. I felt even better about him when I knew he had a military cross.
Yeah, sure.
But, I don't know. It's just that some of us perhaps don't wear it on our pyjamas when we go to bed.
No, that's fair enough. And I kind of think it's that I do get that idea of it's fantastic to be honoured, isn't it? It's like an absolutely, sounds very deserved as well. So it's just that it's like you don't have to then go, guess what,
that's
everyone,
right.
I've got, yeah, you know.
There are people who do.
Yes, I get
and,
that.
And I don't respect them for it. But I came back on retirement to this area. And unfortunately, my father died fairly shortly after I retired.
Right.
And then I decided to devote my life to looking after my mother. And she lived to 100. So I was looking after her for 20-odd years as an unpaid carer, but that didn't bother me. I could afford to. And she got to 100 within 6 months of her 101st birthday when she died just a couple of years ago.
Wow.
So that left a hole in my life.
Yeah.
And I don't regret it for one minute. It was the right thing to do. And when I was in the Far East, I always admired the way that people in the Far East seem to look after the elderly.
Yeah.
They don't push them into homes.
No.
That sort of thing.
No.
And I just felt it was right morally, and that follows the family precept of looking after people, and in her case, looking after her, until she died,
yeah.
Which happened. It also gave me the opportunity to live in Saltash, looking after her in her house. And when she died, and that was just a couple of years ago, I had more time, because my priority had to be looking after her, to see what I could do for Saltash. I'd been very lucky. I'd got several degrees. I'd been decorated. I'd then applied for... I was already, when I came here, a Justice of the Peace.
Oh,
so
right.
I was a Justice of the Peace in this area, based in Plymouth, but with Saltash as part of the area. And for many years, I'd been a JP in other parts of the country,
right,
where I'd been working. And I was able to continue that, serving the community in that way. So Dad served council, I served the Queen in court. And obviously I then had to retire at 70, which we all do, but we did then. I think they've extended it now. And I was able to look and see what I could do with regard to the community. And I've played, I hope, a reasonably full part in the community.
Mm.
Much of it, I have to say, probably involves the military and war,
yeah,
because
sure,
obviously I have a specific interest,
yeah,
and expertise and experience in that.
Yeah.
So that's comprised many things. I think the first thing I did was to lead a group that looked after the anniversary of 6 Saltash auxiliary fire servicemen. And this is a story that not necessarily known in Cornwall, but during the war, Plymouth came under heavy blitz from the German Luftwaffe Air Force. And they didn't necessarily want to attack Saltash. There wasn't a lot here to attack, but there was in Plymouth because of,
yeah,
the dockyard, because of the civilian population, which was obviously very large. And on one occasion, 21st of April 1941, they were under such severe pressure, they put what they call a call out, a call to all over the country, even London and Bristol and as far down as Newquay.
Right.
And can you come and help? So over went our 6 auxiliary fire servicemen, one of whom was my grandfather. And they went over a landmine, a parachute mine, in Devonport, and all 6 were blown up.
Oh, no.
It was, in fact, the biggest loss of life in the fire service in England and Wales during World War II.
Really? Wow.
And obviously, I'm very proud of my grandfather. He'd served in the First World War. He joined the Duke of Cornwall Light Infantry. He was in the infantry for whatever part of the First World War. In the Second World War, he was too old to be called up, but he joined and was the trainer in southeast Cornwall for the auxiliary fire service, who were civilians doing that as a part-time job.
Right.
And there is a story that, well, I can't say I enjoy telling it, but I think could be important for your archives. It reveals just how lucky you can be in life. Now, he was the trainer, and he'd done his day's work in Torpoint, training the Torpoint crew, came back, and my step-grandmother had his slippers and his meal all ready in front of the fire for when he came home. Instead, he went to the, I think it's the Brunel pub, that had a mess restroom for the auxiliary fire service, and in the car park, where there is now, they used to do their training with the hoses and so on. When he got there, he found out that the duty crew of 6 was one short.
Wow.
And he'd done a day's training, and he volunteered to go. Typical of the family.
Yeah.
Because they were one short. And the vehicle was a taxi, all 6 crammed in, and they towed a water pump.
Wow.
I mean, this is not high tech.
No.
To fight the sort of terrible fires and bombs.
Yeah.
But somebody else volunteered as well. So there were two of them who weren't part of the duty crew. My granddad was one. And the station officer had to make a decision as to which one of the two, my grandfather or the other man, should go. One would go, one would stay. And the other man drove one of the council vehicles around Salt Ash. And justifying his decision, the station officer said, Frank, Francis was my grandfather's name, I'm going to send you with the duty crew because the other man knows every road in Salt Ash like the back of his hand because he drives a council vehicle. So in a way, he's more valuable in that sense for us to get to fires in Salt Ash quickly. He stayed behind. My grandfather went over and with the other five was killed.
Wow.
And it was almost like a toss of a coin.
Yeah.
And many, many years after, I used to walk down 4th Street, Salt Ash, with my father. And we enjoyed that, being together, going to the regatta together. And there was this man, this elderly man, and if ever we saw him, he would be incredibly nice to us. Now, many people in Salt Ash were nice to my father, most, without any doubt. However, this man was actually even more friendly.
Yeah. Mm.
And there was something there. And psychologically, I couldn't quite place what it was. And then all my father would say was, well, he's nice to us because he knew your granddad. So I said, oh, well, OK, Dad, that's the reason. He knew your father, my grandfather. I thought no more about it. When we were doing research for the, I think it was the 70th anniversary of their death in Plymouth, I found out that he was the one who didn't go.
Wow, wow.
And my father never knew.
Oh, your father didn't know,
so you found out, but no. My father never knew. No one had told my father. My granddad got killed, so he wasn't able to tell the tale to my father, who at the time was in Scapa Flow with the Merchant Navy and the fleet. And it was only all those years afterwards that the relative, much younger relative, of course, of that man said to me, do you know the story? And I said, no. And he said, well, my whatever it was, grandfather or whoever, told me this was the story and how lucky he was to survive.
Wow. So you must have also, you get that survivor's guilt and everything, don't you? That kind of, oh, wow.
And I think he may have had that to some extent. Mm. And he was a lovely, lovely man. And I now know the full story. I regret that my dad never did.
Yes.
And that happened. So we have been very lucky because I think it was the 70th, a few, 2 or 3 years ago, was the anniversary in 41, of 41.
Mm.
And it was during COVID.
Right.
And there were two groups who were going to commemorate it. We were always, as families, going to commemorate the six relatives that we had. But then what could almost be seen as a rival group was set up called a Blitz Committee. And I've got a leaflet that you can see they produced. I actually, and I'm sorry, this is not going to sound good, but I've got to say it. I actually said to that group, why don't we join together? Because it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, of course, yeah.
And they wouldn't allow us to.
Really? Wow, how bizarre.
Perverse.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Especially if you were relatives.
Yeah. So they went ahead and did their Blitz Committee without having any of us, the family, on that committee.
Mm.
In all fairness to them, they widened it a little to the people who got killed in the Blitz in Salt Ash.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just the
six
firemen.
Yeah.
But I saw no reason why we couldn't join together, pooling our resources and knowledge, which only the family had.
Mm.
And this was around COVID.
Right.
So, of course, there were problems. When you invite VIPs, you don't expect there's going to be a rival or another organisation.
No.
And we always intended to ask very senior people, and by that I'm talking about the Lord Lieutenant of Cornwall, Colonel Bolitho, who was fantastic, as was the Bishop of St. Germans, and the High Sheriff of Cornwall, of course the Mayor of Plymouth, mm-hmm. and so on, and they did the same.
Wow, okay.
Which of course caused me embarrassment, because later on, over COVID, they were going to do what was probably going to be a smaller event in the fire service, the fire station at Salt Ash, which was very small and wouldn't comply with COVID rules.
Sure.
But I was determined, the sort of determination of my family, not to give in. So I waited until the day before the event, knowing that there was a possibility we could comply with COVID rules and distances, because St. Stephen's Church, which is our family church and where they're buried, could accommodate legally a good number of people.
Yeah.
And I had the embarrassment of being phoned by some of the VIP's officers saying, you've cancelled. And I said, no, we haven't. And they said, well...
confused with the two, yeah.
They did. And I remember saying to them, quite plaintively in many ways, I said, if there is any chance of us going ahead on the day, because it's got to be the day, I don't want to postpone it, it won't have the same force. I really do want to do it on the 21st of April, and if we can't, we're not doing it. And you know, those officers said to me, are you serious? I said, yeah. Morally, I want it done on the day, and if the rules preclude it, and I accept we have to comply with national standards, then we will do it, or we won't do it at all. Well, luckily, my goodness me, I was dying death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah, sure.
However, we were able to do it.
Right.
And the beauty of it was we had an incredible turnout, because as luck would have it, and as I get older, I appreciate that luck does exist and is important. It was the first time those people, including the chairman of Cornwall Council, who was a personal friend, it's the first time they'd ever all got together since the start of COVID.
Wow, okay.
So not only were we pleased that we had a wonderful service and did what we needed to do, I think, pretty well, but we also had a full turnout of probably the biggest turnout of VIPs in Cornwall over that period of time.
Wow, okay, that's great.
And we felt we did justice to the memory of those firemen.
Very brave people, yeah.
Yes, wow. And of course we were incredibly grateful to everyone. And my only regret was we couldn't fill the church because... That was COVID.
Yeah,
So we were restricted in numbers, but we felt it would be right to the memory of the six firemen to have as good a turnout as we could to commemorate their sacrifice in what was the 70th year, I think it was.
Yeah, wow, that's long. Luck was on your side in many ways, although COVID was a difficult time, wasn't it? So it's like, that's the thing, is I'm a celebrant sometimes, and so I'd had to do a couple of funerals during COVID, and it was very hard, that thing of when you know a church would be full and you have to kind of accept that it's going to be perhaps fewer people, but that sounds incredible.
And my mother died during COVID as well, so her attendance was very low compared with what I believe it would have been, because of numbers. Well, my mother was born in Kent, and she came from a very large family, and she started off as a children's nanny, and again she had to leave school at 14, whatever it was, and really met my father when he was stationed in Chatham in the Merchant Navy. She then came down to Salt Ash to give birth to me and was a terrific support to my father during his career. She was, I suppose, the old-fashioned housewife and mother, where she didn't go out to work. I think in those days it was felt if a woman went to work, the man wasn't earning enough money. So she always kept her house and everything spotlessly clean and that sort of thing. Did a wonderful job, I think, of bringing me up.
And is it just you? Have you got brothers and sisters?
Just me. Yeah. And she always said, and it was very interesting to the family who brothers and sisters who had more children, she said, I'll never forget this, I'd rather have one and bring him or her up properly.
Aww.
Rather than have a number and not being able to do the job properly. And so I guess, right or wrong, I'm the result of that. But she was a very loving person, and I'm sure was a brilliant nanny because she just adored children and looked after my father and me incredibly well. I was very happy just being what in those days, the 40s and the 50s, 60s, was an archetypal housewife. No real ambitions, just to look after her man, her husband and her son. Did have some interest later in life in yoga and flower arranging and that sort of thing, but for the most part was quite a very sociable, warm person. Perhaps a bit timid, actually, in many ways. Not a lot of self-respect, which is a pity. My father and I used to try to bring that out, but it was her nature, and she was happiest, really, mostly just in the home looking after her family. Mm. And also having, when we lived in Pembrokeshire, her family throughout the summer coming to stay with us for a week or two at a time. So that gave her the chance, because in those days, Milford Haven to Kent was about 300 miles.
Right.
That was quite a long way. And so she kept in touch with her family in that way. Incredibly strong physically.
Right.
Gardening, would dig and do all that sort of thing. Cooked incredibly well. Did all the household chores. But then had a bit of a surprise. And also, I think I would have to say, because I admired her and, of course, loved her, she helped my father in his examinations.
Oh, right.
I used to tease her, saying, well, how could you possibly do that? Because she always said that, you know, she was not educated and so on. And but apparently she would test my father. And, of course, being an Admiralty pilot, it requires a lot of knowledge and testing. So she would sit with a book and ask him questions, and they did that, and she therefore was an underrated, I think, influence on him being able to qualify as an Admiralty pilot, Master Mariner, that sort of thing. We moved back to Saltash from Kent when I was 18, 1962, and shortly afterwards, having started to buy this bungalow in Saltash, Dad became a counsellor because he was missing something in life. Service, I suppose it would be seen as. And there came a time a few years later when he would have been a candidate to be mayor.
Oh, right.
And apparently, I didn't know this at the time, she said to him, if you take up the offer of the appointment of mayor, I'm going back to my family.
Oh, no, really? Oh, dear.
And I believe she was serious.
Oh, really?
There was no way she had the confidence to be the mayoress.
Oh.
And anyhow, that was the threat that she made. So for years, he wouldn't take the job on. And eventually, he succumbed. And he felt, I've just got to do it. So many people are wanting me to do it. And apparently, I was away at university or in the Navy at the time. Apparently, he came back one night and she knew it was what they used to call mayor choosing. So she said, well, who's mayor then? And he said, me.
Oh, no.
I don't know how the rest of the conversation went, and I'm not sure that I ever want to.
No, fair enough.
But anyhow, she did give in, and she became mayoress, which pleased me. Was incredibly timid and embarrassed at wearing the chain of office. But I think she held Dad to ransom, because she said, if I'm going to be mayoress, I've got to be properly dressed for it. So she did get a number of very good ladies' outfits to wear to represent the town.
Yeah, and fair enough. Yeah.
Just as he purchased suits, yeah. Brand new suits, even to the extent where he had little tabs put on the shoulder so that the gold chain, which is a wonderful Saltash Mayor's gold chain, would slit into and it would hang properly. That's real attention to detail.
Yes, yes.
And you just sewed in these little like patches that the chain fitted into.
Okay.
So they had their year, and she always loved to tell the tale of how one of her first appointments for the mayoress rather than being with the mayor, was to bowl the first bowl at Saltash Bowling Club. So, of course, my mother, knowing nothing about bowling, turned up in high heels.
Oh, no, on the bowling green.
No one had told her, you know, this is the way of doing things, and she wasn't into bowls anyhow. No. So what did she do? She promptly took off the high heels, and the local paper carried the story, Mayoress Bowles' first bowl in flat feet. So she did it. I think her nylons were, you know, there in the dress. So she loved telling that story. But I was able to do my bit even then, because even though I wasn't living here, I used to write her speeches.
Oh,
she used to die a thousand deaths over her speeches.
Right.
So I said, well, no one will mind. Dad will do most of the talking. He's mayor. But if you're doing an event on your own, you can do it. And if I was home, I would go with her. Would have been wrong for the mayor, perhaps, to have gone with it, because she was just invited as the mayoress.
Yeah, yeah.
But, so I would go with her if I was home at that time on leave. And I always wrote out, I said, no one will mind if you read
a
speech. And it doesn't need to be long, and people will know that you're not a public speaker. So I would write out, print out, as well as I could, some cards for her, and she did it beautifully, because I was there to see it. And therefore, that was good. And it took away a lot of pressure and stress from her.
Yeah.
So then, and they had a very happy marriage. She supported Dad when he was chairman of Carradon District Council, which was obviously a very important job, the whole of southeast Cornwall. And they went to Buckingham Palace, garden parties and various other things. So they did get a lot out of it, as well as contributing.
Yeah.
In her later years, she knitted teddy bears. We found out that, or she found out from a friend, there was a charity called something like the Newspaper Charity.
Yeah.
And apparently there were, and I really like this story, and I haven't thought of it for years. It's just come out now to me. Mm. The idea was that the little black children in Africa, in certain countries, didn't have anything to cuddle or hug. And I'm a bit of a hugger myself. And I sympathised, I empathised with this. And the idea was that ladies, mostly, in this country, knitted small teddy bears, and then they were filled with newspaper or other fillings, and they were sent out to Africa and then distributed to children in Africa to have a teddy bear of their own to hug and to cuddle. So even though she was well into her 90s, she was doing this on a regular basis for that charity.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought was lovely.
Yeah, that's gorgeous, isn't it? Very caring.
Yeah. So she was caring. I hope I was. I'm sure I didn't do the job as well as I might. and I don't regret for one minute that what I did, giving up, if you like, not giving up, but doing that for 20 years, there's no way I would have put her into a home. The one thing I would say as an unofficial carer is, had I known now what I know then, I wouldn't have changed what I did for one second. But in the early days, when she was more mobile and active, rather than towards the end when she wasn't, I would have carved out more time for myself.
Right, okay.
And I didn't.
Right.
I gave myself to the caring role. Don't regret that. But on reflection, I might have been a better carer
if you'd had a bit,
if I'd been able to say. It is true that one day a fortnight I was a magistrate, and that was good. That gave me a release, gave me something to help my self-esteem to some extent, and to feel I was contributing. But it probably wasn't enough. I probably should have said, I would like to join one or two local organisations, try to get a few friends and what have you. But I didn't. And I would think that if anyone is in that position, you don't know how long the haul is going to be.
Yeah, sure.
I had no idea it was going to be 20 years.
Yeah.
However, I do think it's important if you can, because it will probably help you, yourself, and make you a better carer.
Yeah, yeah. If you're looking after yourself too. Yeah. That's. But I think you're right, is that kind of... because you don't want to feel selfish in that moment, do you? But actually, if you give yourself time, then you're better. You feel better in yourself,
indeed,
don't you? So you can be a better person to care.
Absolutely. And I think that would be my advice if anyone ever wanted to seek it. But it worked because she kept incredibly healthy. She did have a couple of minor strokes, but nothing really that serious. And thankfully, when she did pass away at the age of 106, 107 months, there was no real pain. She just faded away and died in bed. And yeah, that was it.